The food will come. We'll get started first and make the siyum. Before we finish Maseches Avodah Zarah, I would begin by stating Baruch Shechiyanu v'kiyamanu v'hagiyanu l'zman hazeh. A siyum, I think, is both a time of celebration and a little bit of a time of reflection. The Gemara in Brachos, which we will not see this Gemara today, but the Gemara on Daf, I think, Yud Aleph Amud Beis, near the end of the first perek, speaks about the obligation of making a Birchas HaTorah. If you get up to learn in the morning, Hamashkim, you know, Lishnos Pirko, you get up to study what you're going to study, so you have to be Mevarech Tila. You can't study Torah before you make Birchas HaTorah. And the Gemara asks, well, what is Birchas HaTorah? So first, it provides the version of the beginning, or Birchas HaTorah, Sh'er Kedishanu Mitzasav Etzivanu, La'asok B'Divrei Sarah, and some version of Aharevna, Sfardim and Ashkenazim, obviously have different, slightly different Nuscha'os. And then, after finishing that bracha, so the Gemara quotes another opinion, which is, it's the bracha v'asher bachar banu mikolam imenu asalanu v'shtarasel, brachat Hashem nasein HaTorah. And Rav Hamnuna comments about that. He says, Zohi ha-me'ula shebe-brachos. This is the best of the brachos. The Gemara then concludes, therefore we should say all of them. Okay. But the question is, what was Rav Hamnuna's statement? And so Rashi just comments, he says, Zohi ha-me'ula shebe-birchos ha-Torah. It's the most significant of the birchos ha-Torah. Lefi sheyeshba hoda'a la-makom. There is giving gratitude, expressing gratitude, giving thanks to God. V'kilus le-Torah le-Israel. And praise of Torah and of the Jewish people. And I think that this is really a central point. I think that there are things that we say all the time. I know I'll speak for myself only in davening, and I've said it literally probably, I don't know, thousands of times, and I don't actually think about what I'm saying. And I haven't thought in the first place really what I'm saying, because first I learned to daven, then I learned to understand. But my wife observed, she has a lot of astute observations, but recently she made an observation that it's not a chiddush. You read the bracha that we say before Kriya Shema, either Ava Rabba, the way Ashkenazim do it, Ava Rabba in the morning, and Avas Olam at night. And really what we say is that Kadosh Baruch Hu giving us Torah and giving us mitzvos is an expression of love. Very often we live in a world in which the sense of having obligations and duties and responsibilities is seen as a burden. But that's not what the bracha is portrayed as. It's Ava Salam Amcha Beis Yisrael Hafta. And what is this eternal love that God shows to the Jewish people? Torah u'mitzvos chukim mishpatim osanu limadata. You're basically giving us mitzvos to observe and you taught us Torah. And what Rav Hamnuna is telling us about this bracha is that what this bracha is saying is Asher Bachar Banu Mikolam and Asalanos Torah, so that giving us the Torah with all it, both the opportunity and the obligation of studying Torah and the mitzvos is really an indication of bechira. It's an indication of love, of choosing, not some type of a burden. And I think that in a world in which I think more and more of us have come to understand that the search for meaning has become something very difficult, living in the society in which we live, when I reflect upon the Torah, when I reflect upon studying Torah, teaching Torah, that I get up every single morning, and I don't not know what I'm going to do that day, because I know the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to get up and I'm going to say brachos, and I'm going to daven and things of that nature. It is genuinely a gift in a world in which there are so many people adrift searching for meaning. So the truth is, this is the opportunity to study Torah, the opportunity to teach Torah, I view as perhaps avas olam amcha beis Yisrael ahavta. A few thank yous. Firstly, I wanted to thank Rabbi Lookstein, who's not here, Rabbi Weinstock, for initially inviting me to become part of this beautiful community, and Rabbi Steinmetz for continuing this kasher. I have to say that I don't like to say this publicly, but it's pretty well known in YU circles that that YU has an ability to make almost everybody who works for it feel underappreciated. And I don't say that as by means of knocking YU as much as to say that this is one of two institutions in my life where I have worked at that institution. I have felt deeply, deeply appreciated. And I say first and foremost thank you to the rabbis because you set the example for this kehila. And I have to tell you, getting up every Sunday morning, even except for August, during July, I don't see it as a burden or as trouble coming in on a Sunday morning. It's really a delight for me, and I very much am appreciative for what you've done for me. I also want to thank my wife, who's not here. She's, I think, by now, hopefully in sunny Florida for a conference. But otherwise, I suspect she would have come. I thank her for everything that she does. I think I can say Rabbi Akiva's famous statement about his wife, Rachel, which is, Sheli v'shelachem shelohi. I would also say give her a specific thanks because when I began here, so we decided there was going to be a main part, and this is really the Ikar, the weekly Gemara Shir. You know, coming to Shabbos is beautiful for us. We really love coming, but that's icing on the cake. But this is really, this is what's truly important. And the question was timing. And I've given Shir elsewhere before, many years ago, and it was like a Tuesday night, and it was really rough. You know, every single week. And she was the one who came up with the ingenious idea of why not Sunday morning. So it seems to work for a lot of people, and certainly works well for me. And that really, just that little chachma and that idea really has made a lot of things easier. And my last thank you is to you, to the Talmidim, to my Talmidim. I often don't like to think of it. Some of you are younger than me, many of you are older than me, but I guess Talmidim in some sense all. There's a Gemara in Arvei Pesachim, the last parak of Meseches Pesachim. Usually, most people who learn it don't learn this Gemara. It's kind of neither the beginning nor the end, in the middle. And the Gemara tells the story that when Rabbi Akiva was in prison, when the Romans had imprisoned him, so his student Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai came to him and said, "Teach me Torah." And Rabbi Akiva refused. And I don't really understand this. Rabbi Shimon threatened him. He said, "If you don't teach me Torah, I'm going to tell my father Yochai, and he's going to be moser you to the Malchus. He's going to give you over to the king." He was in prison. I don't know. But anyway, Rabbi Akiva said to him, you have to understand, Yoser Mimasha rotza ha'egal linok, haparat rotza lahanik. More than the calf wants the nurse, the mother cow wants to nurse the calf. And he was telling him that more than you want to study Torah for me, more than you need to study my Torah, I need to teach Torah. And so very often people study Torah with a teacher, with a Rebbe, and they think that they are the beneficiaries and they're the ones who need it more. But in reality, Yoser Mimasha Egel Rotze Linok, Hapara Rotze Lahanik. So I thank you. I know that many people take time off to come learn Sunday morning, and I am deeply grateful for that. We left off a few weeks ago in Avodah Zarah, and we were talking about knives. So we want to briefly finish up the topic of knives. The Mishnah had said, how do you kasher a knife? So the Mishnah had it previously described. It said things that you cook where there's a liquid medium between the iser and the pot. So you use hagala, you use boiling water. That's how we typically kasher. And then, if you have something that you normally use without a liquid medium, so then you have to do libo, and you have to put it in fire. And then the Mishnah said that hasakin mashchiza vihitora. Hasakin, and the simple way of reading this is you sharpen the knife, and it's good. And the question is, what does sharpening the knife accomplish? What can you use it for? So the opinion that's not found on the page, but the opinion of the Rambam, and I believe it's the opinion of the Mechaber in Shulchan Aruch, not surprising, is that the way you kasher a knife, no matter how treif it is, by sharpening it. That is what sharpening does. You're literally removing the outer layer, any part that would have had absorptions in it, and therefore, once you sharpen a knife, once you thoroughly sharpen it, you can use it with hot stuff. It's a complete hechsher. And it makes sense in the context of the Mishnah, because the Mishnah is not giving you half-baked measures. In other words, when you do hagala on a pot in the Mishnah, you can now use the pot for anything. When you do libun on a spit or on a grill, you can use it for anything, you know, as hot as you want, whatever chamin you wish. And so, therefore, when you sharpen the knife, presumably that would be the same thing. However, the Rashi and Tosos do not understand that way. And if we now look at the Gemara on the last Amud, Daf Ayin Vav Amud Beis, so on the fifth line, the Gemara quotes the Mishnah, Hasakin Shofa Vihi Tahora. So the Sakin and Rashi is in the first interpretation, it means to sharpen it. You sharpen the knife, and the knife is now Tahora. So now the Gemara comments, Amar Rav Ukva Bar Chama, Rav Ukva Bar Chama says, V'noatza Asara Pa'amin Bekarka. He says that you take the knife and you stick it into the ground 10 times. Now, I want to just read a few lines in the Gemara. We mentioned this in a previous year, but I'll go over it. But before we talk about what this means, let's just read a couple more lines. So the Mishnah said, shafa, let's say it means to sharpen it. Rav Ukva Bar Chama says you stick it in the ground 10 times. Amar Rav Huna Berei the Rabbi Yoshua, uvikarka she'ena avuda. It means in hard ground, ground that has never been worked before, it has never been plowed, so the dirt is really, really hard. It's not like sticking it into soil in a flower pot, right? It's really, you find a piece of hard karka, you know, presumably not wet, not moist, not muddy. You stick it into the ground 10 times, and the Yushalmi says that you don't, I think it's in the Yushalmi or the Rishonim say, you don't stick it in the same spot each time. Each time you stick it into a new place. So that's what you do. Okay, and then Amar Rav Kahana, Uvisakin yofe she'ein bagumos. This only applies to a knife that's in good condition, that is not pitted. It doesn't have little nicks and things like that. It's a smooth blade. So if you want to kasher, whatever the purpose is, whatever you're kashering it for, if you want to kasher the knife, it has to be a smooth knife. It can't have little gaps and things like that. Tanya Nami Hachi, the Gemara says, we also have a braisa. Sakin yofe she'ein bagumos, no atza asara pa'amim bekarka. So it puts the two things together, that if you have a knife that's really that's good condition, you stick it into the ground 10 times and it's good. And now here's the last line. Amar Rav Huna Bered Rav Yoshua, lechol batzonein. That is if you want to eat cold stuff with it. Not if you want to use the knife on something that's hot. You want a new knife on something that's hot, what is just described is insufficient. So the question is, what is the Gemara, the whole discussion, qualifying? So the position that I mentioned to you before of the Rambam and the Mechaber in Shulchan Aruch is that the Mishnah is talking about if you want to use it for hot stuff, anything you want to use it for. Shafa, which means to sharpen it, to be mashri, is the knife. That's if you want to kasher it like you kasher a spit, you kasher a grate, you kasher a pot. That is a full-blown hechsher. But now the Gemara, in this discussion, is not talking about a knife, using a knife with hot stuff. It's saying, but let's say you don't need to use the knife with hot stuff. I just need the knife to cut cold things. So now the only issue is, when I'm cutting cold things, at least according to this Gemara, I'm not going to go into the broader discussion of knives and the problems they bring about. When you're cutting these cold things, so the knife is going to have shamnunis, it's going to have, stuff. I mean, whatever you want to call it, fatty stuff or little pieces of whatever the issur, the prohibited food that was cut. So the question is, how do you clean the knife really well? What was the word, Marshall?
Residue,
thank you. Okay. So how do you clean the knife? In halacha, we would say, to get off the be'en, the stuff that's still physically visible and extant, okay, the residue on how do you get it off? So that's what the Gemara is saying. You want to get it off. Again, they didn't have running hot water and soap the same way we do. It wasn't easy to clean stuff. So the way you clean your knife is you take it and you stick it into hard ground 10 times. And by doing so, if the knife, in fact, has a smooth blade, so the food doesn't get lodged in the cracks, it will do a very good job of cleaning off the knife so that at least now you can cut cold stuff with it. If there's stuff absorbed inside the knife, where heat will extract that. So this obviously does not help you in extracting the absorptions from the knife, but it does help to clean off the surface of the knife. So now when you're cutting stuff cold, you're only worried, at least according to the Gemara here, about the surface of the knife. That's the way the Rambam reads it. Rashi and Tosos, although it's not so relevant to this, both assume, if you take a look at Rashi for a moment, Rashi says, V'lecho botzonein, it's about 12, 13 lines up from the end of the Rashi's. He says, Aval davar roteach, something that's hot, osur lachtokba, you can't cut with this knife, ad shi agilena birotchin ukli rishon, until you do hagala, which means in boiling water, and the kli rishon, which means the pot on the fire. Okay, now, we mentioned this briefly, but it's worth reviewing. Tosus points out that there is a Yerushalmi, this where Rashi got this idea from, that Hagala is what's necessary for a knife, was the Gemara Pesachim that we learned a few weeks ago. Where Ravashi said, they asked him, what do you do for a knife for Pesach? And he said, well, first I put the mud around the handle. I get new knives. So they said, that's nice, you're wealthy, but what about somebody who can't afford it? So Ravashi said, no, I mean, I make it like it's new. How do you make something, a kli, like it's new? You do liban on it. You put it in fire. So what does he do? The wooden handle, he puts mud around, or clay, or something around it to protect it from the fire. He then puts the blade in fire, and then he removes the mud, and he does hagala on the entire knife. That's what Ravashi did. And the Gemara, after quoting that statement, says, yeah, okay, but the halacha is idivi idi barotchen. All you need to do is take the knife and stick it in boiling water. So that's where Rashi is getting this idea, that the way you kasher a knife is by immersing, doing hagala, immersing it in boiling water, and that's all that's necessary. The problem is that there's a Yerushalmi that says that a knife requires libun. You have to stick it in fire. And the question is, is this a machlokes? How do you put these two together? And there are, fundamentally speaking, two ways of resolving this contradiction of, does a knife require only hagala, only the boiling water, or does a knife actually require libun? The first one, which is the one that's adopted by Tosos here, and this is a big debate amongst the Rishonim, is based upon a Gemara we learned on the previous page, which is, the Gemara there says that when the thing that you're kashering to get it out if when it was absorbed, it was actually mutter to eat at the time. Then, it was called heter. Let me frame it that way. It was called heter. Then, for some reason, Gemara doesn't really explain, you never, ever, ever, ever need to do libun. In other words, generally, the way we distinguish between whether something requires only hagala, only the boiling water, or requires libun, is how it's used, in terms of how it absorbs. If it absorbs with a liquid medium, then only hagala is necessary. If it absorbs directly with the fire, no liquid medium, it requires libun. But the Gemara on Amud Aleph established this idea that if when the food stuff, is absorbed into the vessel, at that time, it is called heter. The Gemara's example was kachim. You're cooking a karban. Then, it is never necessary to do libun. It's always sufficient to do hagala on such a vessel. In other words, whatever you get, the assumption is, libun gets rid of more. Hagala, on something that really requires libun, doesn't get out everything. It gets out most of it, but it doesn't get out everything. But some reason, without explaining, the Gemara says that if when it absorbs something, it's called hetera bala, it swallowed it when it was heter, then even a vessel normally that would require libun, because it was used directly on the fire, hagala is enough. So what should this apply to? Well, it should apply to a milchik pot, it should apply to a fleshik pot, it should apply to a kutchim pot, because those are all things that when they absorb, the stuff that's being absorbed is heter. Now, there's one more possible candidate for this, and that is chametz before Pesach, right? You might say then, if you have a chametz tikka vessel, you might say, according to the Gemara, it never, ever, ever requires libun. Why? Because chametz before Pesach is heter, and therefore, even a vessel that was used directly on the fire with chametz, hagala should be sufficient. And there is a whole group of Rishonim, including Tosfos here, and major machlokas, but many Rishonim will say, yes, that's correct. And therefore, as long as the vessel is cleanable and accessible and no little cracks where the food gets stuck, you would never need to take out the blowtorch for Pesach. Of course, the rabbis know that that's not true. The Mechaber doesn't paskin the way. The Mechaber, who talks about Libun in the laws of Kashrut and Pesach, he's assuming that even though you're allowed to eat chametz before Pesach, obviously, that chametz before Pesach already has this status. It has the status of Isser, because Pesach is coming, and therefore, a vessel that was used with chametz directly on the fire without a liquid medium, in order to prepare it for Pesach, you would require libun. Now, but Tosos is one possible way to resolve the contradiction between the Yushalmi here in Avodah Zarah and the Gemara in Pesachim. The Yushalmi here in Avodah Zarah says you need to do libun on knives, but the Gemara in Pesachim says you only need to hagala. So Tosos says, yeah, because Pesachim is talking about chametz, and chametz, Tosos says, is hetera bala, and once it absorbs it when it's heter, this is Tosos' position, you never require libun. That's why the knife, no matter how you used it with chametz, the knife doesn't require libun, hagala is enough. Whereas the Yushalmi here is talking about, not chametz, we're talking about Avodah Zarah, non-Jew stuff, we're talking about the Isser Mamish, actual Isser, and therefore it requires Libun Hagal, if the knife was in fact used directly on the fire, and that's what would seem to be the assumption, that's how it might be used, then it actually requires Libun. Marshall?
A couple of questions. One, when Rashi says Avod Roteach, means boiling. Is he setting a different temperature?
No, that's just the expression the Gemara uses, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Two, given that sharpening a knife only obviously removes the very, very, very cutting edge, how can we need Rabbi Yeshua to come after a whole up and dry in the Gemara to finally tell us that this is only with sonar? How could the Mishnah have a Havamina, or even the first part of the Gemara, that merely sharpening the edge of the knife permits you to use the entire knife, because presumably if it's sliced through trait, the whole knife...
So you should have a better question. The better question is on the Rambam. How does the Rambam hold that hashchaza, that sharpening, is enough to use it for anything? Right? But I would just say that if the Rambam at least could think that was his position, somebody else might have had a havamina, that it's something that would be acceptable for hot stuff. You're asking why the Gemara say, why does the Gemara have to tell us k'dei lecho botzonein? I'll give you a better answer. Forget the Rambam. Because the simple reading of the Mishnah is that shafa is for everything. Because why would the Mishnah tell you, okay, you want a kasher pot? Hagala. Use it for anything. You want a kasher a spit and a grate? Now you do libun, it's kosher for anything. You want a kasher a knife? Shafa, which means to sharpen it. Oh, but by the way, that's only if you want to cut cold. It doesn't fit well in the Mishnah. There is, by the way, another interpretation that could have made peace between at least Rashi and the Rambam. The Rashi explaining the word shafa on the Mishnah is actually on our page, and Rashi quotes two interpretations. One is to sharpen it. The other is to rub it in a cloth or something like that. And that would fit better than, you know, then maybe there's no debate. But it's a question that remains on the Ramadans. Why does he feels that really taking the outer layer of the blade side is enough, and that's apparently, you know, why aren't you worried about the size of the knife and things like that?
Right. I mean, a sheephood basically is a vertical knife, right? It has a very sharp tip that you push through the meat, and then the whole rest of it is in the meat. I mean,
he's not talking about a shpud. He's talking about, in other words, the Ramam will say a shpud requires libun.
Now,
the
spit.
In other words, it's the rest of the spit.
It's not easy to differentiate between a spit.
Yeah, agree. I hear what you're saying. Correct. Correct. I agree.
My guess is like a hollow grind, a modern knife. Probably they did whetstone sharpening on a full blade.
Yeah, but no, you never sharpen. You sharpen the edge.
No way.
Okay. Okay.
It's very tough.
You slice through a big fat salami with a knife where you can sharpen the edge.
It's right, so Marshall, I'll give you the other possible answer, even though it's not really sufficient. The assumption may be that I'm not saying by this way, that when you're cutting something, it's really mostly the blade that comes in contact, because as you cut, the thing divides, and the sides don't make so much contact. But okay, yeah, I know, I get the sides of the knife get 32. I got it. Okay. All right, so now the Gemara continues, and the Gemara says the following. So there's a second, that's one way of resolving the contradiction between the Yerushalmi that says a knife requires libun and fire, and the Bavli that says it only requires a hagala. The other possibility, and Tosus assumes this is true as well, is that there are different kinds of knives. Rabbi Nutam distinguishes between a big knife and a small knife. A big knife, he assumed a sakin gadol is something that would have been used with meat on the fire itself. A small knife you wouldn't have used that way because you would have gotten too close to the fire or for some other reason. So Rabbi Nutam says that he thinks that you also have to distinguish between two different kinds of knives. And it could be, that also could have been the resolution to resolve the difference. And I think other Rishonim, that is what they would say. Those Rishonim who believe that chametz before Pesach is called Isur Abala, and therefore chametz stuff does require in principle libun when you use it directly on the fire. So they can't resolve the contradiction by saying in Abu Dazara the Yushalmi is talking about Isur, and in Pesachim the Bavli is talking about chametz before Pesach. Because for many Rishonim, chametz before Pesach is the same thing for these purposes as Isur, and they would have to resolve it by saying they're talking about two different kinds of knives that were used in two different ways. The Gemara in Pesachim is talking about knives that would never be used directly on the fire, and the Gemara in the Yushalmi of Odizara is talking about knives that were used directly on the fire. Okay, so those are the two ways of addressing this contradiction. The Gemara now concludes with the following story. The Gemara said that this hechsher of sticking the knife in the ground is to eat cold stuff. Kiha de Mar Yehuda ubati Bartuve have a yasve kame de Shvormalka. Shvormalka was the Persian king, and these two fellows, Mar Yehuda and Batu Bartuvi, were sitting. They were dining with Shvormalka. They're hanging out with him. It probably wasn't the meal. Aisu lekamayhu esroga. They brought in front of him an esrog, some type of a fruit, and pasak achal. He cut off some with his knife, and he ate. Pasak v'havle lebati bartuve. He then cut off another slice and gave it to Bati Bartuve. Then, hadar dotsa asara zimne ba'ara. He stuck it into the ground 10 times, and then, pasak havle lemar Yehuda. Then, in other words, he kashered the knife to giving to Bati Bartuve. He didn't kasher the knife. To give to Mar Yehuda, he did. So, amar lebati bartuve, vahu gavra la bar Yisraelu. What? He told me himself. What, I'm not from? So Amar Le, he gave him two answers. Both are actually very, very telling, each in their own way. Mar Kimli Begave, Mar Lo Kimli Begave, Mar Yehuda, I know he's from. I'm very familiar with him. You, I don't know about your from kite. In other words, there's a sense, Kimli Begave is an expression that means a deep familiarity with the character of a person. So he says, Mar Yehuda, I know. You, I don't know. In other words, means Mar Yehuda obviously had some type of a reputation of being genuinely from. Ika da Amre, of course, there's a second version, which is Amar Le Itkar my avadet b'orta. Remember what you did last night. So Rashi here quotes, I don't know what Rashi's source for this is, but Rashi, the last Rashi in the Masechta says, Derech Parsim Limsar Noshim L'Achsenoi. So the minhag of the Persians was to send escorts to their guests at night. Uchashashigran Lahem, and when he sent them Belaila Shavar the previous night, Kibel Bati accepted. Umar Yehuda, Rabbi Yehuda lo Kibel. Rabbi Yehuda turned it down, and that, of course, report came back to Shmuel Malka. So Shmuel Malka said, "I know that you wear a big kippah, whatever particular stripe makes you look from, and your tzitzis are hanging out, and so on and so forth." He said, "But remember what you did last night? So, you know, of course, when it comes to Mar Yehuda, I sent him the same offer, and he said no, thank you, because he's genuinely from. That's why I just assume it's not important that you have the glatt kosher food with the knife." Tosus, of course, Kedarka Bakodesh, and it's not that Bati Bartuve. I don't know how often he appears in Shas, but it's not like he's someone we have to defend. But Tosus makes the claim that, technically speaking, Bati Bartuve had been an Eved. He had been an Eved Kanani, a Jewish Eved Kanani, and he had been freed. But when you free an Eved Kanani, so when you own an Eved Kanani, not someone who's Jewish to start with, who if you buy him, you're just really buying his labor. But an Eved Kanani, who might have started, either was born that way, or he started out as non-Jewish, but he converts most of the way. So when you own an Eved Kanani, there are two aspects that you own of an Eved Kanani. Number one is that you have a Kinyan Mamon, you own his Masei Adayim, whatever he works, and you also have a Kinyan Isser. You in effect have control, not control, but your owning him has an impact upon his status, that he's an Eved, or if a woman, it's a Shivcha, and there's no Kiddushin with an Eved or a Shivcha, and so on. All sorts of ramifications in certain areas of a person's personal status. When you free an Eved, so both an Eved or a Shivcha become fully Jewish, both your rights over their work dissolve, and they also become basically fully Jewish. They in many ways have the status similar to that of a Ger who converted, a Ger or a Gioris. But there are situations where you can dissolve one bond but not dissolve the other. It's a machlokas, but I think Rav says that if you declare your Eved Hefker, so your rights to have his work anymore are gone. He works, he keeps it himself. The Kinyan Mamon, the monetary hold you have on him, is dissolved. But he still, for marriage status purposes, he still has the yichus of an Eved. The only way you get rid of the yichus of the Eved is by writing a get shichur, a shtar shichur. Right? You write this, the shtar, it's similar in concept to a get isha. When a man marries a woman, he only has, it's only a Kinyan Isser, in the sense that there's a status change. A man does not own his wife in terms of property things. Certainly not fundamentally speaking. You can have arrangements, but by an Eved, once you dissolve the monetary bond, there's still a yuchsin question, a personal status question, and that's what the get shichur dissolves. So Tosa says that Bati Bartuve was actually allowed to take Alpidin, was allowed to take Shmuel Malka's offer, because he was technically still an Eved, because he hadn't yet received the get shichur. Okay, it's based upon another Gemara in Kiddushin, but anyway, that's what Tosa suggests. But either way, I think the real point of the story is that sometimes people put on a show of frumkeit, but sometimes when you scratch beneath the surface, the people maybe you thought weren't so frum are really frum, and the people that you thought were so frum are actually not so frum. Hadron alach asocher asapoel uslik alach meseches avodazara. Hadron alach meseches avodazara v'hadron chalan, daitan alach meseches avodazara daitan chalan, lo nisteshemi alach meseches avodazara, lo nisteshemi non, lo ba'almadein, lo ba'almadasei. Hadron alach meseches avodazara v'hadron chalan, daitan alach meseches avodazara daitan chalan, lo nisteshemi alach meseches avodazara, lo nisteshemi non, lo ba'almadein, lo ba'almadasei. Hadron alach meseches avodazara v'hadron chalan, daitan alach meseches avodazara daitan chalan, lo nisteshemi alach meseches avodazara, lo nisteshemi non, lo ba'almadein, lo ba'almadasei. Yiratzel mufanecha adonai elhein v'lehev Hanina bar Papa, Rami bar Papa, Nachman bar Papa, Chai bar Papa, Abamari bar Papa, Rafan bar Papa, Rachish bar Papa, Surcha bar Papa, Ada bar Papa, Dara bar Papa. Harem no Adonai Lehenus the raised Torah Sahabafinu, Ubefifios am Chabes Israel, and Yakulano, Anachnu Bitsa, Enu Bitsa, Am Chabes Israel, Kulano Yodishamecha, Velomde Sarasecha, Mayavaita Hakmani Mitsosecha, Kilam Hili, Yehili Bisamim Bukacha Lamano Evoshla, Olam Lashkah, Pikudeha, Kivam Hisani, Baruchato Adonai Lamedeni. Kishem Shazar Tanu Lassai Mesechas of Odezara Kain Tazrenu Lahaskal Mesechtos Visfar Machirum Lassimon Lumo Ulalamed Lishmar Vlasos Lakayim is called the Raised Talmud Torah Secha Beava Uskuskla Tanaim Vamorim Tamidecha Chamim Yamod Lonu Ulazarenu Shalotamusha Torah Mipinu Mipizarenu Vizara Zarenu Adolam Visis Kayembi Besalachatan Chaosach Beshach Mahatishmar Lecha Vakitsosa Hisicha Kivir Bumacha Vasifa Lachashnos Chayim Orech Yamim Bimina Bismala Osheva Chavod Adonai Ozla Moyitain Adonai Yivarech Esamo Vashalom. Okay, we'll just spend 2 minutes, start the first Mishnah Brachas, and then we can move to the Sudas Mitzvah. It should be easy to find the place. And that I can't help. Okay, we spoke last week a little bit. We introduced the mitzvah of Kriya Shema, and the Mishnah here starts to deal with the times of Kriya Shema. Me'imasai Korin Shema Ba'arvin. As I pointed out, and the Gemara does sort of ask, there's an assumption here that you realize that there's a mitzvah of Kriya Shema at night. So Me'imasai Korin Shema Ba'arvin. From when do you read? When can you read Kriya Shema at night? What's the time period? It should be noted that the Gemara, as far as I know, nowhere else asks the question, when you have a mitzvah that applies at night, when can you do the mitzvah? The answer is, at night. What is the definition of night? Okay, so, I mean, we know, definition of night goes from Tzeis HaKochavim, from the three stars until Amud HaShachar. So why is the Mishnah asking, Me'imasai Korin Shema Ba'arvin? The answer is because Kriya Shema is not a mitzvah whose man necessarily is Yom or Laila, but rather it's B'shoch Becha Uvkumecha. And so what the Mishnah is really asking is, what is the definition of Zman Shechiva? Presumably, since most people sleep at night, and most people spend much of the night sleeping, there's an overlap between the two. But what is the definition of Bishach Becha? So the Mishnah says the following. Mishah shekohanim nichnasim lechol b'trumasan. If a kohen was tamei, let's say a kohen touched a dead animal, so a kohen can't eat truma when he's tamei. So what he does is, if he touched a dead animal, he goes to the mikveh, and then when sunset comes, he's allowed to now eat truma. When the day ends, when he has what's called harev shemesh, when the sun has gone. So there is, whatever that time is at around nightfall, so the Mishnah says, Mishosha kohanim nichrasim lecho b'trumasan at sof ha'ashmur harishona, until the end of the first watch, which the Gemara will quote two opinions, but this opinion, Divrei Rabbi Eliezer, is that the night is divided up into three watches, each 4 hours. So according to Rabbi Eliezer, you can first read Kriya Shema when nightfall comes, and you have until 4 hours, or a third of the night, in order to have completed the mitzvah Kriya Shema. When you read the opening line of the Mishnah, there is an ambiguity, and the Gemara points this out. It's not clear whether this is all Rabbi Eliezer's opinion, or only the terminal time is Rabbi Eliezer's opinion. In other words, it might very well be that the opening statement, Mishah Shakonim Mitrachsim Lacho B'Trumasan, semicolon, that nobody disagrees with that in the Mishnah. And there are going to be three opinions on the terminal point. So now, the Mishnah, without stating it, now we're going to look at what's the end point you can read Kriya Shema. So the first opinion is until the end of the first watch, Divrei Rabbi Eliezer. V'chachamim omer ad chatzos. They say until halfway through the night, until midnight. And Rabbi Gamliel omer ad shilam amrashacha. Rabbi Gamliel says until morning. Now the Gemara will grapple with this, and it becomes clear in the story as well. Rabbi Eliezer's opinion and Rabbi Gamliel's opinion make sense. If the definition of Kriya Shema is b'shoch b'cha, so Rabbi Eliezer says it's when people normally go to sleep. So you could say the first 4 hours of the night. If you want to say it's when people go to sleep, then presumably you have to say it is when people are sleeping. People do not, most of us, do not normally just sleep until chatzos. So Rabbi Gamliel's position is, kol zman shebnei adam shochen, as long as people are sleeping. Rabbi Eliezer's position is, kol zman shebnei adam hochem lishkov, that's whenever they go to sleep. But what is this in-between position? So the story is told. Maaseh ubo bana mi beis hamishneh. His children came from the party house. Not sure what that was, or with his approval or not. But amru lo lo karinu es shema. They said we didn't read shema, and it was after chatzos. Amar lahem im lo ala amur hashachar chayavam atem likros. And this Gemara will explain, they knew what their father's opinion was. They were asking, what did the Chachamim hold? So he said, the Chachamim agree with me in principle. If you haven't read it and Chatzos comes, you still have to read, and you can read it until morning. But, velozo bovad amru, it's not just with respect to this case, but elakoma she'amru Chachamim ad Chatzos. Anytime the Chachamim say that a mitzvah's time, a mitzvah of the night only goes until Chatzos, really, mitzvasan asheyelam an ashachar, the real terminal time in HaTorah, is when the morning comes. Ah, but hekter chalavim veivarim, mitzvasan asheyelam an ashachar. Now the truth is, burning the fats and the limbs that have to be burned on the Mizbeach can be done at night. The truth is, the Chachamim, as Rashi points out, never even said only to Chatzos. It happens to be Hekter Chalav Mevarim, Chatzos isn't even mentioned. You can do it all night. But the next one is true. If you say Ezehu Mekoman, V'chol HaNeachalim L'Yom Echad, all karbanos, where you can only eat it one day, the meat, one day and one night. So a karban chatas, a karban todah, a karban asham, a mincha, all of those karbanos, the Mishnayos say you can eat it until Chatzos HaLayla. You eat it the day you bring the karban and until Chatzos. So Rabbi Gamliel says, really, min HaTorah, the time goes all the way until morning. Acheyalam Rashachar. Im Kein, lama amru Chacham HaChatzos. Why did the Chacham tell you that you have to do it by Chatzos? You really have all night. The answer is, Kedei Laharchik Adam and Aveira. It's a siyag, it's a gzeira, it's a geder, it's a decree to make sure that we don't transgress. So they said, if they tell you have until Amar HaShachar, then you know this, you have an assignment to do for school this week, and when do you do it? The last possible moment, right? So if you're like most of the rest of us, so therefore the Chacham were afraid. When it comes by Kriya Shema, you're going to miss the mitzvah Kriya Shema. It's a very important mitzvah. By Karbanos, if you eat it after daybreak, you chayv karis. It's nosar. So it's serious aveira. Therefore, at least in those cases, the Chacham told us, even though min haTorah, really you have until Amud HaShachar, until morning, nonetheless, you have to do the mitzvah before Chatzos.